Find a physical therapist, find an energy therapist, you know. Goddamn, I don't care if crystals get you sober. Use crystals to get yourself sober. You know, there is something that will work out there for you. And if nothing else, I'd just be happy to tell you about all of the different options and maybe point you in the direction of some groups or some people or some resources that might help you.
Welcome to Give a Heck. I am your host, Dwight Heck, and for much of my life, lived my life in quiet desperation, wondering how I was going to pay the bills, take vacations, save for retirement, and one day wondering if I would get off the hamster wheel of life and have purpose. A life that most of society lives, which takes us to work, then home, then repeat, and pays us hopefully enough just to survive. The harsh truth that most live with more month than money and have no idea how to live life on purpose, not by accident. This ensures the mass majority are living not just financially broke, however emotionally and mentally as well due to financial pressures. In each episode, I will introduce you to thoughts, ideas, and guests that can help you to learn how you too can live life on purpose, not by accident.
Good day, and welcome to Give a Heck. On today's show, I welcome Duncan Baskerin Brown. Some people say that Duncan can help you go beyond alcohol, but that isn't it. Duncan will help you increase your energy, power up your productivity, improve your relationships, and enjoy the heck out of your life. After 20 years of overdoing it, he cleaned up his act and trained with the world's most successful stop smoking service. But that wasn't enough. He studied at Cornell University, the Chartered Management Institute, and in a windowless room in Petersburg. But that wasn't enough. He wrote a couple books, most recently Real Men Quit, The Armchair Macho Guide to Beating Booze and Finding the Life You Want. But that wasn't enough. He started interviewing the sober superstars and conducting research projects which involved watching TV. But that wasn't enough. What would be? Maybe if an alcohol-free was the default, if sober was the new normal, and if alcohol stops destroying people, maybe Duncan will sit down with mint tea and sci-fi novel and relax. Maybe. I'd like to welcome you to the show, Duncan. Thanks so much for agreeing to come on and share with us some of your life journey.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to it. I think I'm going to enjoy the heck out of it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and you're on the perfect show for that, right? Give a heck. So, you know, I smiled when I read the bio you sent me and it said in there, heck. And I was going, you know, literally, I would be a real wealthy man if I could just convince the world to pay me even a quarter of a penny every time my last name said, because it's not just North America. It's said all over the world. When I was in Europe last year for 3 weeks, I heard it all the time. And when people found out that was my last name, it was even then they have even more fun. Right. Because then you hear all the stuff that I've heard since I was a little kid. Everybody's got that heck joke. Right. So it's all good, though. Right. It's I'd rather be. You know, famous for something like that than famous for other reasons, right? There could be a lot worse things to be famous for.
I'm not sure whether Dwight Heck trademark has got such a good ring to it, you know.
I don't know. Give a Heck's trademark to my country. I actually own the trademark for that, for my actual brand. Yeah, so I don't know if branding my name would work. I don't think they'd allow it, but... You know what, maybe in the future, we'll see. But Duncan, I look forward to our conversation. You know, after doing research on you yesterday afternoon and just getting to try to understand your life and where you come from is impossible from just reading. So I look forward to hearing the audible. And for those watching, you get to see Duncan as well, his handsome face, right? Coming across the pond, talking to us, which is a good thing. So Duncan, one of the things I focus on, as we talked about, is a person's origin story. It helps the listeners get to know, like, and trust you and accept you in a very short period of time, because you become relatable to them. So I'd really appreciate it, Duncan, if you could share your origin story and what key things from your childhood to adulthood that led you to where you're at currently.
So I think it helps to imagine a warehouse. and fill that warehouse full of party, you know, loud music, flashing lights, sweating bodies. And instead outside, you got a little sort of 15-year-old Duncan, and he is properly nervous. He is scared because he's got to go into this party and he's got to do adulty things. And that girl that he's been following around for the last couple of weeks is going to be there. And he's got on his best t-shirt and he's had a shower and he's all excited about it, but he's pretty scared. He's nervous. You know, what's he going to say? What's he going to do? And then one of his friends hands him a can of lager, which, to be fair, he didn't really enjoy that much. But, you know, it starts off in the toes, doesn't it? And then all of a sudden there's this kind of tingling, this feeling of relaxation. And all of a sudden, you know, little Duncan, he's strutting through the crowd. He's like John Travolta on a Friday night, isn't he? You know, he's strutting the light fantastic. And it all ends completely happily with him going off with that particular girl. And, you know, that was kind of my first experiences with alcohol. They were all about going to parties and, chasing girls. Basically, parties and girls. That pretty much sums it up. And the thing was, I was quite nervous when I was a teenager. I didn't really know what my place was in life. I didn't really get on very well at school. School was not a place that was set up for the likes of me, shall we say. So I didn't have very many places where I felt like I could succeed. So I had all of these kind of issues around nervousness and identity going on. And, you know, somebody put a can of lager in my hand and they seemed to all disappear. You know, I seemed to be more confident. I seemed to be funnier. I seemed to be more attractive. And it all started off like, you know, all of my Christmases came at once. It seemed like alcohol was the greatest thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah, it is something that is masking at a level. I felt for everything that you talked about. I wasn't a very confident person in my teens either. And just talking, as you were talking and sharing, my high school years popped back into my head. And I thought about the first time that I ever drank. I had a friend that handed me, we were at a, what I call a bush party. So we were outside, we were, you know, had a fire somewhere, hidden by trees, we're in the bushes, trying to stay away from the quote adults. And somebody handed me a beer and similar feelings to what you're talking about, right? I was a very shy kid. I was bullied. I was picked on most of my early years into high school. I became very sheltered and introverted because of it. And that alcohol all of a sudden made me what I thought was a superhero. I was impenetrable. I was bulletproof. But in reality, it started a process in my life that wasn't the greatest, right? Got in trouble because of alcohol. Moving forward in my life, do I drink still today? I do casually, yes. Certainly, I feel sorry for the people, though, that it engulfs their whole life. And that's one of the things I wanted to talk to you more about. So today, and, you know, Duncan, today's world, as we know, everybody turns to alcohol and it's so normalized. Every TV show, movie, sports, especially sports, they bombard you with it. And now gambling. I don't know which is more prevalent in sports because I'm a hockey fan and in the playoffs right now, it's either bet, 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 drink, 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 right? There's no in between of healthy. And that unhealthy causes so much family problems. You know, you watch those shows in the middle of the day in the evening and they're pouring drinks to people in the middle of the day or in the evening. And it's not normal. That's not normal life. You don't walk into a lawyer's office and they pour a drink and start drinking while they're having a meeting with you. They don't pour a drink for you either. Let's hope they don't. At least the lawyers I deal with in my life, I've never had that happen. So people are programmed to believe that it's okay. Maybe it's cool that these people on the screen that are having even wine or champagne with breakfast is neat. Maybe we need to be the cool kids. They think it's so great. So tell me your specific take on all of this and how effectively do you see this affecting the world?
Well, you know, I grew up watching stuff like James Bond. So I grew up immersed in this environment where you know, I was absorbing these messages that told me if I wanted to be tough, if I wanted to be sophisticated, I wanted to be successful with the ladies, I needed three things: a white tuxedo, a Wolfer PPK, and a martini. Shaken, not stirred, you know, and absolutely, that was the environment I grew up in. That was part of the reason why I felt more confident when I was drinking, because, you know, I had been told it would make me more confident. And why did I feel more grown up and more sophisticated? Because all of the adults I had ever seen drank alcohol. So if you want to be an adult, what's the easiest thing to do is to drink alcohol. So, yeah, we're absolutely immersed in, you know, it's like we're poured into a glass. We're not born, you know, we are literally poured into a glass. And it had a huge effect on me. It certainly underpinned a lot of my beliefs about drinking. It underpinned my beliefs about what I would get if I drank. And I think the research is pretty clear about that. What you believe about drinking is very strongly correlated with the amount that you drink. And I did start drinking quite heavily as I got into my 20s and 30s.
So with all of that, so you got heavily into drinking and stuff, and it ties into associations, right? A lot of the people you probably hung out with would have had to be people that were similar to yourself, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really cemented my drinking prowess at university. And I think that's the same for a lot of people. You know, you go to college and everybody drinks in college. So yeah, I didn't think I was doing anything out of the norm. I didn't think my drinking was unusual. I didn't think it was, special in any way. And as you say, I mean, sport is a great example. I was quite interested in rugby when I was younger. That's sort of like American football, but not quite as complicated and not as many pads. Again, you know, all of the major competitions in rugby are sponsored by alcohol, just like two of the top 10 advertisers during the Super Bowl happen to be Budweiser. It's like, yeah. Bud and Bud Light are so heavily advertised, they take up two slots in the top 10. And that's what we start to associate, you know, alcohol with: strength, power, success.
But we also, when I said association, though, it's not just about that. I mean, like, the friends that you hang out with, the family you hang out with, you're more likely to, if you're a person that's a big drinker, going to want to hang out with people that drink. Just like people that smoke cigarettes, they all of a sudden quit. And in order to stay quit, they got to disassociate with the people that smoke at work in that smoke corner or outside of the bar or whatever the case may be. I find we literally will gravitate toward, even if we have a large family, we'll sit with the people that are drinking and the people that aren't drinking. We can't tell you a lot about them because we're not associating with them, right? And that's what I found is such a prevalent challenge today, is how do we change our associations so that we can remove the addictive things that are in our lives, not just alcohol. It can be drugs. It can be addicted to being depressed and sad or angry. There's so many different things. Do you have a secret that you use to change your own personal associations?
Yeah, I mean, so for me, I think there were two types of heavy drinker in my life. There were the people that I hung around with and drank with simply because I felt better being with them, because they, you know, their drinking seemed to make me look good. Sometimes they'd drink more than me, or at least they'd make me seem normal. So there were a bunch of people who I really only associated with because our behaviors matched. And then there are another set of people who drink quite heavily who I still spend time with, because actually underneath all of it, we had a lot more in common. Generally, it's around shared interests or shared history, personality, sense of humor. You know, there's more than simply the drinking. So on the one level, there were a bunch of people who our relationship was based on alcohol, and I don't talk to them anymore. But the people who I actually had a lot more in common with, and I still have things in common with, I do spend time with. And I think to be able to do that, you've got to get yourself to a point where you don't want to drink, or where you don't want to smoke or take drugs or whatever, because if you don't want to do something, then it's quite easy to spend time with people who are doing it. You don't feel tempted. You know, there is no temptation. If you don't desire something, you can't be tempted to do it. So I spend, you know, not a lot of time, but I still have some friends who drink quite heavily. I'll go to parties where they're drinking. I'll go to social events where they're drinking. I'll talk to them, usually up until about 10 o'clock, half past 10, when they stop making sense and I start ignoring them and talking to the people that aren't drinking.
So, and that's, I understand what you're saying. Eventually you can hang out and associate with those people, but it takes time. I don't want people listening to think that it's, because I know a lot of people that are recovering alcoholics. They have been some for 10, 15 years. They have to avoid those associations. You're right. They can hang out with people that they formerly did, but they have to keep that time very short, right? So that, because why would you, in a healthy state of mind, deciding you don't want to drink anymore, be around people that affect your mindset negatively, right? So we may not agree the same, but I know just from experience, I think that it's better personally that a person walks away from those associations and limits their time. Like, there's people in my life that I limit, not necessarily because of alcohol addiction, other reasons, right? I keep it very short and sweet, unless it's family related or tied to friends that we have mutual. Many of the people in my life that have challenges that can cause me some strife, I walk away from.
I'll give you an example. So Morris dancing.
Yeah.
You're probably thinking, what the heck is Morris dancing? So what the heck? Morris dancing is a kind of English folk dance. You know, it's most, there's lots of different ways of approaching it, but the typical ones, you dress in white, there's lots of bells, lots of ribbons, maybe a hat with some flowers in, waving hankies around, dancing in a very traditional English way. And I'll be honest with you, I started dancing because there's a lot of drinking that goes on with the dancers. And it's a pretty good excuse, apparently, to be in the pub at lunchtime or even earlier sometimes. So when I first started dancing, I was drinking and I hung around with a load of guys who drank a lot, and it all seemed lots and lots of fun. And then when I stopped drinking, I was a little bit nervous. So I was like, well, what do I do? Do I just knock it on the head? But I was like, well, you know what, part of me quite enjoys it. So I went along a few times, and what I discovered was that what we have in common is far more than alcohol. What we have in common is tradition. You know, we enjoy doing the same thing. There's this kind of communal pursuit. There's friendships. And actually, there was so much more to it than alcohol. You know, there was no way I wanted to give that up. And I'm not going to stop doing things that I enjoy just because people in that situation are drinking alcohol. I understand why some people do, but I think if you can get the beliefs sorted out, if you can really get to the root of the problem and understand, you know, why are you drinking? You're drinking because you believe that you're going to get a good outcome from it. And where did you get those beliefs from? Well, you got them from James Bond and the Super Bowl. And so you've got to examine them. You've got to ask whether they're true or not. And even if they are true, are they helping you become the kind of person you want to be? And, you know, if alcohol doesn't help you deal with stress, and it doesn't help you to socialize, and it doesn't make you better looking, then, you know, you start to lose your desire to want to drink it. So actually spending time around people who are drinking becomes a bit immaterial. And for me, you know, I wouldn't want to lose all of the positive things that I get from dancing: friendship, community, silly hats, exotic locations, you know, the exercise. I love dancing. You know, I love so much of it. I wouldn't want to sacrifice that simply because people were drinking at the same time. So I think there are ways of finding, you know, a balance and finding a way of managing the situation like that.
So, And I appreciate what you're saying. That, of course, why would you want to give up that? That's so much more deep than just a friendship with a friend, right? That is heavily drinking. And no matter what you do, you meet up with them, the first thing they're doing is pouring a drink, or they've already been drinking when you reach them to connect up. The dance thing is completely Understandable. Did you initially have to avoid it, or were you struggling through it as you were still continuing to go to the dance? Was there a time period where you had to get to a point mentally where you were emotionally and mentally strong before you could go back to dancing, or did you just keep on going through the whole process and just working through it as it went?
Yeah, I mean, I was... The day I took my last drink, I knew that was my last drink and I was never going to drink again. And I was done with it. And, you know, I believed then, as I believe now, that there is no benefit to drinking and it would not enhance my life one little bit. So I don't miss it. So I went out with that attitude. I mean, yeah, you know, there was a lot of work that had to be done. And it's 9 years since I stopped drinking. And, you know, it's still quite a bit of work that has to be done.
Congratulations,
that's the next
though.
Life, isn't it? Yeah.
Congratulations. 9 years, a long time.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, yes, there was some baby steps to start off with. There was a little bit of getting used to it, redefining it. There was a, you know, people take the mick out of you. My favorite one is they occasionally say to me, you know, Duncan, you don't actually live longer if you stop drinking. It just feels like it. You know, so they still take the mick out of me. And there was a period of rebalancing. And of course, there is a period of stabilizing. Once you stop drinking, you know, it's not like stopped and done. There is this period of finding a new way to socialize, finding a new way to relax, finding new ways to deal with difficult emotions, to help you to kind of stand in front of the problems that you were invariably trying to ignore by drinking. So there was, you know, part of that period of stabilizing. But I think it's a bit broader than just rebalancing your friendships. And, you know, yeah, my advice to people is sometimes you do just have to curate your friendship group. You do just have to say, yeah, this person is not offering me anything. And you're absolutely right. I think that goes so much deeper than just drinking. There are some people who just suck the life out of the room when they walk in. And why would you want to spend time with people like that? Why would you not kind of, I've been very deliberate over the last sort of 9 years or so about trying to spend more time with the kind of people who I admire and I like, and I want to be more like. And yeah, that's part of the reason why we're talking today.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I like your response.
I want to be more like a successful podcast host than I do the guy down in the bar complaining about the government, you know?
Well, and, you know, at the end of the day, people commiserate and alcohol accelerates, right? It accelerates that commiseration and their inability to think positive. I found it time and time again, whether it's just one individual or a group of people. It doesn't even have to be alcohol as the addiction. And that's why I say sometimes you just have to walk away with individuals. But I never thought about it in the extent of what you were talking about. So I appreciate you sharing about the dance, because when you have so much good, you can't allow one negative to pull you away from all the good that you get from it. And you figured it out. And I appreciate the honesty too, because those listening or watching, when you leave addictions or you have that epiphany and you start taking those baby steps, it takes time, and you need to ensure that you're okay with being vulnerable and getting somebody in, you know, maybe hiring a mentor like Duncan to get through those hills and valleys. I find that in my own career, helping people through their life challenges, right? Things that they're going through, because it's all tied to money, is very cathartic for me, but it takes time for them. So I have to feed it to them in small, you know, bites, like how do you eat an elephant? Like they say, one bite at a time, right? Little small little nibbles, and realizing that sometimes when I'm dealing with them too, we do pull them back into a situation where they can still enjoy the stuff they're enjoying in their lives. They just have to, like you said, accept how did they get here? Maybe they got to unpack their own garbage and accept and speak it out loud. And it's really tough. I don't know, maybe you've experienced it where a person can do it on their own, but I know myself throughout my career and helping people and getting help myself for certain circumstances, the more I can share, not even necessarily getting advice from, let's say, a Duncan, but Duncan listening and nodding his head and commenting once in a while, I figure out a lot of it myself because finally I'm unpacking it and not hiding behind a screen pretending to be all healthy when in reality I'm got the little airline bottle of alcohol in my pocket and I'm knocking it back in between walking around a corner where nobody sees me. I'm not hiding in the shadows anymore.
You know, I think you're absolutely right. I think what we sort of lack as a society is space to reflect and think things through. And I think that's what a decent coach, therapist, mentor, counselor, priest, call them what you like, you know, that's what they offer you. They offer you an environment where you are comfortable and safe and you're actually able to think through your own problems. And, you know, one of the greatest things that happens to me, and it happens to me quite regularly, is I'll be discussing something with somebody and we'll be talking about, you know, what they believe, the wonderful things that alcohol does for their lives. And they'll start off with something like, I'll say, so yeah, what's the benefit? They'll go, oh yeah, alcohol helps me deal with stress. Although now we're talking about it, I do get quite worried about the amount I'm drinking. And actually, I feel terrible in the morning and it always, you know, starts the day off badly. And, you know, then it doesn't really get any better and it just gets more and more stressful. And, you know, it's affecting my relationships and that's causing me a lot of stress. And actually, now you come to mention it, Duncan, alcohol is probably the biggest form of stress in my life. And it's like, brilliant. I didn't say a word. And you have just, because you've had to like actually vocalize that belief that you've had for years and years and years and has been holding you back and has been affecting your actions. But because you had to say it out loud, because you had to justify it to another human being, you did a very smart 360. And I absolutely adore it when that happens. You know, that is one of the main reasons why I get out of bed in the morning.
Oh yeah. Those light bulb moments, those epiphanies. I'll be sitting with a client and we're discussing stuff and I'll ask them, what are your monsters in your life? What do you mean? What are your life monsters? What holds you back? I see all these goals that you've written down that you want to accomplish and you want to achieve all this stuff. What's holding you back? Why haven't you done this? What has held you back? What has been your experience that you wouldn't have just stepped out on faith and done it? And I want them to unload, because a lot of times they'll sit there and pause and they'll go, you know what, I've never thought about that. And sometimes it's a quick response and then they're, you know, they're letting it all out or as much as they can in that first experience. And the next time they're just shaking their head. You know what, I really don't know how to answer that. I've never thought about it. So then I have to let, obviously, you don't want to push people too far, because you can, especially as a person that mentors and coaches people, you can understand this too. If you push a person too far, you can push them to not get help, right? So do you find there's a specific thing or way that you deal with that circumstance when you're mentoring people?
So I do challenge people sometimes. I do, intervene is not quite the right word. I mean, one of the things about coaching is it's supposed to be completely and utterly non-directive, and you're just supposed to work to the client's agenda. And that is 95% of what I do. It is about what you want to do. But sometimes I do feel the need to just stand up and say to somebody, do you know what? You're selling yourself short. I think you're being a bit silly. I think you should reconsider that. But you have to be very, very careful with that, because I like you say, you know, I've got to help you to see that I'm on your side. I've got to be your support. Because if I'm too aggressive, then I'm that horrible man who's just trying to steal your alcohol off you. And, you know, who wants to talk to him? Like nobody. So I'm not, you know, you've got to balance this kind of need to offer people this security and comfort and this unconditional positive regard and things like that. But then sometimes, you know, I do think it is our responsibility. I think a real part of love is to challenge people and to say, come on, you can do a bit better than that.
So tough love, right? A little bit of tough love. And yeah, I feel that. And sometimes it's not perfect, is it, Duncan? Sometimes I think that, like as you say, you just have to say, come on, you know, you're worth more than that. I believe in you. And sometimes that that's the kick in the pants, I'll say, that they needed, right, to get them past that hurdle. And other people, it causes them to, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? They become more into themselves. They regress in their in where we're going. And I think to myself after the fact, I reflect back on meetings, or I'll outright ask them, you know, did I say something that was that triggered you? Did I say something that wasn't that you can't, you know, get on board with? Let's talk about it. And, you know, you can still get past that hurdle, but there's also those times where it's just that person just isn't ready. Wouldn't you say that happens to yourself? Sometimes people just aren't ready. And then you as a mentor have to walk away as well for your own peace of mind, for your current clientele, for your current family situations and yourselves. We have to protect ourselves, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And in general, most of the people that I have ever spoken to, they know that they want to change, even if they're not really prepared to admit it in public, and even kind of a little bit to themselves. So I get every now and again, I'll get a guy, and he'll be there simply because his wife made him. It's like his wife is annoyed with his drinking and he's got to do something about it. So he comes along and he sees me as the enemy. And, you know, I am here to spoil his fun, and I am an idiot, and I don't know anything about his life. And all he's going to do is listen to me for a little bit, and then he's going to go home and tell his wife that it didn't work, but he tried, but nothing's really ever going to be able to change, so he can just go back to drinking. Sorry about that. And, you know, when I meet people like that, it is absolutely just about kind of help them to understand that I do know where you've been. I mean, yes, you know, your life is different. You know, you're absolutely, your experiences are different. You're sat in a different seat, in a different house, in a different town, but you've got the same poison in your glass and you've got the same rubbish in your head. And I've been there and I have done that, and I've got the t-shirt. I just don't wear it because it's got kebab stains on it. And you know, it's helping people to understand that I do understand where they're coming from, and I'm not here to judge them, and I'm not here to take anything away. And it's just building that rapport and getting them to a point where they're comfortable enough to say, do you know what, Duncan, I really don't enjoy it anymore. I'd love to change. I just didn't think it was possible. So what do we do? So I don't know, maybe I am just an incurable optimistic, but I am always optimistic about people. You know, they will find a way, and they do want it. You know, I've never met anybody who drinks heavily who really enjoys drinking heavily. They will tell you that they enjoy drinking heavily whilst they're drinking, before they're drinking, after they're drinking. They will wear their hangover as a badge of honor. But if you really get down to it and you really open up the doors and you give them that love and that unconditional positive regard, they will admit to you that they're not enjoying it. So I think there is hope for everybody. Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes it doesn't work. I am not the universal cure for all of mankind's ills. Sad to say, if I was, you know, I'd be on some sort of dais. I'd probably be in a book. I'd be venerated the world over. But
you'd be on Oprah. You'd be on all these shows, and you wouldn't be talking to little old me if you were the cure to everything that humankind suffers through. I appreciate that, though. It's true, though. You know, I've had clients, you know, 21 years of doing this, and I'll have conversations with them. And even sometimes I think everything's going just perfect, right? Even the goodbyes, the meeting's over, and they don't respond to messages after the fact, right? And it's not even necessarily something that you or I have done. I don't know if that's happened to you. They don't respond to your messages because they just aren't there yet. They may know that, like you said, drinking's not good. In my circumstance, they may know that their financial train is about to go off the rails, and they're going to lose everything. They're going to lose their marriage. They could possibly lose their job. And a lot of what I deal with, a lot of those people are alcoholics. They've used alcohol to mask. So I'm dealing with so much more than just the monster of money. It's the monster of addiction. And I try to leave the door open for them. You know, I'll leave a voicemail message for them because they don't answer the phone, or I'll message, email them, just say, you know what? I'm here for you. When you're ready to take that next step, I'm here, right? Just reach out. Let's keep on moving forward. And 50% of the time, I do. 50% of the time, you never hear from that person again. And I always wonder about those people. And am I spending a lot of time thinking about it? No, because that's a waste of valuable energy I can help other people with. But I do think about it or reflect on those people once in a while. Think about, that individual, that couple. Sometimes it's businesses that I coach. And think to myself, where are they today? I hope they found somebody that could get through to them. Right. And then for me, I'm a praying person. So I'll pray that I get the strength to maybe next time say it differently. Maybe next time present it differently. Not saying that I was the root of why they didn't do it. Maybe just some sort of tool that I could, help them out of their quicksand that they're sinking in. Because today it's so prevalent, the amount of people that are stuck in addictive personalities through alcohol, drugs, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of it happens because of childhood struggles. A lot of it happens because of even, as you mentioned, you're being that 15-year-old kid. We go through so much in life and we don't have enough support. And, congratulations on being somebody that's willing to be vulnerable, share circumstances and go out and make a difference and help people get off that, for some people, it's a crazy train. They're just like you said, they wake up hungover, they go to bed, there's everything about them is alcohol, and they're literally a functioning alcoholic, pardon me. And people like you are needed, so that's great that you're here on the show sharing your knowledge and support for others.
It's my pleasure, and I just want to circle back to something that you said. I think you have the right attitude that As helpers, what we try and do is we try and help people. And I think the correct response when it doesn't work is to reflect on it and think, well, what could I do differently? How could I help them more in the future? Whereas what I see a lot of the time, not a lot of the time, but maybe too much of the time, is that people are quite dogmatic about their system. And they say, well, you failed to implement the system properly, and that's why your life is gone to pot, because you didn't implement the system properly. Whereas I think your attitude and my attitude is much more like, well, how can we make the system better so that it can serve them better, rather than blaming them for, not... Well, I mean, it would be very easy, wouldn't it? It's like, well, you didn't call me back. Of course you're lying in the gutter drunk. You could have just had a Zoom call with me and then it would all have been all right. And, I think it's wrong to blame people when they are vulnerable, when they have difficulties, because as you say, you don't know what lies beneath that. You're like money problems. You've got money problems. Yeah, what lies beneath that? You've got a drinking problem. What lies beneath that? Yeah, you probably had one heck of a childhood and, I don't envy you that. So, yeah, I think that's something that we need a lot more of, a lot more understanding and, reflecting on what we did and maybe how we can do it a little bit better in the future. And, I'm enormously aware that I am an acquired taste. Not everybody on this planet is going to like me. And if you just don't like me, that's fine. That is absolutely fine with me. But trust me, there is somebody out there that you will like that will be able to help you. You don't like my methodology? You think it's a bit too cognitive, a bit too psychological? That's fine. Don't worry. There are people out there that can help you. Go and find a good therapist. Find a physical therapist. Find an energy therapist. Goddamn, I don't care if crystals get you sober. Use crystals to get yourself sober. There is something that will work out there for you. And if nothing else, I'd just be happy to tell you about all of the different options and maybe point you in the direction of some groups or some people or some resources that might help you.
Yeah, that's a good attitude to have. I'm the same way. I'll tell people, I like how you put that. Sometimes we're not an acquired taste for people. Maybe they don't like the way we joke. Maybe they don't like the way our tonality is. They don't like the way we look. Who knows what causes them to, but I'll just tell them, if we don't move forward from this point, I understand. I'm okay with that, but please don't give up. please don't allow yourself to stay at the same destination that you've arrived at and be stuck there and be on the hamster wheel of life, right? You don't need to live a life of getting up and going to bed in quiet desperation. There is hope for all of us. And obviously, just like you, I share my stories. And when they talk to me about stuff, I love storytelling if it's done properly and tastefully. I'll use my own stories. I'll use clients of mine's stories, obviously without the personal data, but you know, the gist of the story to make it so that they're more relatable and comfortable, because it's tough, people listening or watching, when you have challenges and addiction issues of any form, to break the chain. And it is something that I found that I have to be very cognizant. And like you said, I reevaluate, you reevaluate. Without that, me thinking that everything should fit inside my little walls of how I've been doing things is very narrow-minded, and it's an ego, it's a bad ego thing, right? I need to keep myself open to the fact that maybe I need to elevate my game. You know, why have I had a few appointments this week where people are seem kind of off? Is it my energy? Right? It's okay to say I need to work on myself so that I can help people work on themselves, right? We're all working project.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, you always learn things from the interactions that you have with people. And, you know, the one thing I don't want people to learn from me is that change is impossible. Just because I wasn't able to help you doesn't necessarily mean that change is impossible. You know, you just need to find the right thing. And I think that's the problem with a lot of methods. They kind of close the door, and then people say, well, you know, I tried, I did this method and it didn't work, therefore I'm stuck where I am. And I think that's one of the real problems that certainly I had when I was drinking heavily, and a lot of people that I've talked to have, is that, you know, we're in a situation where we don't think we can do anything else. Like, literally do not think that our lives would work without alcohol. I mean, in fact, that, you know, that's my favorite way of describing it, is you are dependent on alcohol. You feel like you depend on alcohol to relax, to deal with stress, to socialize, to make your life work. And, you know, just because I haven't been able to help you get away from that doesn't mean that there is never going to be a way of changing. And, you know, helping people to sort of see that there are many, many different ways of getting free. And everybody, you know, it's like the paths to enlightenment. There are a lot of them. There are as many of them as there are people walking up the mountain. And it's the same. Everybody's journey to sobriety is unique. And we just got to find what works for you and what keeps working.
Oh, exactly. I appreciate that. So one of the things that I find very interesting, I don't know what the number is today. A few years back, they did a research study in North America, one in Canada. They were tied together between the US and Canada, that many kids today that go to college and university, by the time they graduate, 65 to 70% of them are alcoholics already. They're already people that are drinking. I guess your definition of alcoholic is, it can be different depending on where you are. My definition of it is if you're drinking alcohol every single day and you're normalizing it and saying, oh, I just, you know, this is what I do. I have a glass of wine after work, or I have a couple beers. You know, they say a lot of that started already, again, in that club, in that party, trying to feel like they fit in, like they were more attractive than they actually are, or whatever the case may be. And they're drinking their faces off. So 65 to 70% of people, like that is high. And I know one of the things that you discuss, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about, is you mentioned WHO. And, you know, there's a lot of documented facts about the effects of alcohol on the world. Can you share some of those facts and what you're aware of, and what segment of the population is most vulnerable to alcohol abuse?
So, according to the World Health Organization, the average man on this planet drinks 19.6 liters of pure alcohol every year, which equates to about 3.5 to 3.75 bottles of wine a week, which is way too much. And I think, you know, men dominate drinking. Not to say that there aren't women who have problems with drinking. Absolutely there are. But for every alcohol, every glass of alcohol that gets sold on the planet, three of them are drunk by men. One of them is drunk by a woman. So we're just outperforming women in that sense. So yeah, men are more vulnerable to it than women. In general, I think the thing that people don't really get is that actually alcohol, it's a problem of success. So the more you earn, the more you're going to drink. And these statistics, you know, bear out. If you look at college graduates, high earning college graduates in the US, 47% of them drink every other day. So if you go into the average employer and you look at the people who have degrees and earn reasonable money, they're basically the people that are running the company, aren't they? You know, there's a 50-50 chance that they were drinking yesterday. And that's quite a worrying statistic, I think. And that's one of the reasons why the World Health Organization says that business executives should be screened annually for alcohol use. Unfortunately, that's something that doesn't really happen. Most healthcare providers don't have the resources to do that. Some companies are starting to warm up to the idea that actually it's very beneficial for them to improve their employees' well-being and to sort of like look after them, because actually happy, healthy employees, well, they work harder, they have better relationships, they're more creative, crucially, they stay in the job for longer. They don't leave because they're not dissatisfied. And also, if you create the right culture where people are happy and healthy, then the top talent wants to come and work for you. So I think a lot of companies are warming up to this idea about well-being. We're just, one of the things that we're trying to do is get alcohol onto that well-being agenda, because it tends to get ignored. A lot of people in the well-being world, as far as I can see, don't want to talk about it. They think it's too difficult. They think it's intruding on people's privacies. They'd rather talk about getting a fitness tracker, some blackout blinds, and a really big water bottle, because, you know, that's easy. That doesn't really involve sustained, difficult change. Whereas, you know, alcohol is quite a thorny issue. You know, there's a lot of stigma around alcohol. So, things are definitely changing, and we're certainly pushing to try and get alcohol more onto the business well-being agenda.
Well, that's so. Would you say then that the business executive is the most vulnerable to the abuse then of alcohol?
Yeah, and I think the statistics back it up. You know, the group, like, you can literally draw a graph. The more you earn, the more you drink. It goes up and up and up.
And I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So, actually, there's another graph. So the older you get, the more you tend to drink. And what does that kind of like, how does that kind of cross over? Well, you know, you tend to earn more when you're older, and you look at senior people in companies, they tend to be older, they tend to be male, and they tend to be more affluent, which are three things which are massively correlated with alcohol problems. You mentioned solicitors earlier. There was some research done in Australia that found over 20% of lawyers are problem drinkers. And, you know, what does that do? You know, like, you're up in court. This is like fairly serious stuff. And the guy defending you's got a drink problem. this is worrying. This is something that I think as a society, we do need to address.
Well, look at the addiction issues it's not just in Canada. It's around the world. I have many clients that are in the healthcare industry. The amount of doctors that abuse not just alcohol, prescription drugs, et cetera, et cetera. And that same person might be your surgeon the next morning, or maybe that afternoon, and it was the morning, and they're so stressed because of their workload or lack of support that they're popping pills. And it's a real problem in our world today where people hide behind that addictive personality to keep them driven and moving forward. And that could be that person, like, lawyer, fine. That scares me. But what scares me is the medical community and how much abuse is going on with alcohol and drugs.
Yeah, and I think there's a deeper point to that. You know, in general, people in the medical profession, certainly, I mean, I'm familiar with the statistics for the National Health Service in the UK. I'm I imagine they're borne out across the rest of the world. But in general, in the UK, if you work in the medical profession, you're more likely to smoke, you're more likely to drink, and you're more likely to have issues with your weight. And in the UK, if you want advice on stopping smoking, stopping drinking, or managing your weight, where do you go? You go to the health service where
they're you know, supposed to know better. So it kind of, exactly. I get it. I get it. I see people, I have clients of mine that are in the medical industry, quite a few of them. And you said overweight, right? And I look at them and I think to myself, you had to take classes on nutrition. You had to take classes on, you know, they do teach them about alcohol and all this stuff. And these same people, they depressive eat because their job stress them out. They depressive drink because their job stresses them out, and they're overweight. They're not healthy. And we're supposed to listen to these people.
It's like,
go on.
It's like taking swimming lessons from a drowning man, isn't it?
Yeah. It you know, and I'm not here to pick on people in the medical industry. I'm not here to pick on solicitors, lawyers, whatever you want to call them. It's a real problem. I see it in my own industry of you know, financial planning. The last 21 years, how many of the people that do what I do, are they giving proper advice based on, you know, what should be done to help that person, or is their own personal lives and their addictive personalities causing them to give advice or direction that isn't necessarily best for the client? And I guess that'll never change in our world because we're all, again, human. We're all, which is a good thing, as you mentioned earlier, but at the end of the day, we're all reflective of what's going on minutes before that interaction, hours before that interaction. What did we go through? And are we, you know, six between our 6 inches, are we stable enough to give the right advice to that person and what they need when we can't even, you know, live a life that's on purpose ourselves? It's kind of, there's no great answer or quick answer for any of it. All I know is that we can only help one person at a time. And those listening and watching, you know, just remember you're worthy. We can talk, we can possibly help you out. Don't let all the noise that's going on around you or what the comments we talked about with medical or with lawyers, it happens with engineers too. I have engineering clients. Like, it doesn't matter what the profession is. Just realize that you don't have to live a life where you're stuck and addicted to something. Life can be pure and simple without addictions. Yeah, that's about all I wanted to say.
Yeah, well, I mean, I talk to a lot of people about what I do. And one of the conversations that I have all of the time is, oh, well, I am in industry X. And a lot of drinking goes on in that industry. And they never say the same things. I mean, you know, things kind of pop up. But it doesn't really matter what industry you're in. You know, there will be a lot of drinking going on somewhere. And that's not surprising because the society we live in, there's a lot of drinking that goes on within society. And, you know, I think there is a real need for structural change. There's need to look at the way alcohol is taxed. There's a lot of need to look at the availability of alcohol, how frighteningly easy it is to get hold of, particularly for underage drinkers. So we need to look at tax availability. We need to look at advertising. We need to look at the education that we offer our young people, how we can protect them, do more targeted stuff. We need to look at treatment. We need to look at, you know, using the tools, because the tools are out there to help people. They're just, you know, they're not well resourced and they're not well used. So if we could increase the tax on alcohol and then use that to pay for some interventions that we know work, because, you know, they've been extensively studied over the last 30 years. And they're very effective. So I think there's a lot we could do structurally. But unfortunately, you know, that's a 25-year project. And sadly, many of the people that I work with, they don't have 25 years. I've worked with a few people who don't have 25 days. You know, they need to change and they need to change now. So it's a matter of coming at it from both ends. So yes, we absolutely need this structural change. We need brave politicians to actually do something about the problem. But we also need, you know, a society where people can discuss it and they can ask for help and they can find a way to get that help because it's not so stigmatized.
Yeah, I agree. And you mentioned taxes. That is a tough one. I know in our province, in our country, they have it automatic now. And there's a bunch of controversy because the taxes on, on alcohol has gone up again and it continues to go up. And people are, obviously the people that buy a lot of alcohol aren't too happy about it. It's the same as cigarettes here. A majority of a pack of cigarettes price is tax. Both on a provincial and on a federal level, there's so much taxes on it. Same with alcohol. And they say they're using that tax money to better educate and better support, because they have to pay out money for people that are in recovery or in the hospital due to that addiction issue. Maybe it's lung cancer because they're a smoker. Maybe it's their liver, whatever the case may be. But taxes is one solution. But your biggest solution that I heard that we need to do is get politicians that wake up and are very vocal about it and put things in place and quit trying to use. I'm not saying taxes shouldn't be high on it or should be low. I don't think that's going to fix the problem. It might be the Band-Aid at the back end of the issue, but it's about people standing up, voting for the politician that actually is going to make a difference. Or maybe you be the person that's just vocal about it, right? It's okay to rub people the right way.
Well, I try. Interestingly enough, there was some research done a few years ago on Canada alcohol tax and the cost of alcohol. So I don't have the statistics to hand because I'm reasonably good at statistics, but I can't remember everything I read, I'm afraid. But the gist of it was that they calculated how much alcohol costs in terms of healthcare, how much it costs in terms of social care, how much it costs in terms of policing, how much it costs in terms of prison service and the whole criminal justice piece. And then they calculated how much it costs in terms of lost productivity for companies. And that was a frighteningly big number. Not only did it dwarf the amount of tax revenue that was taken in by the Canadian government, it actually dwarfed the amount of money spent on alcohol in total. So even if 100% of what you spent on your alcohol went to the government, it still would not cover the cost to the economy. So alcohol is, it is a massive, massive drain on our economy.
Yeah, and it is a massive drain. I look at all the people that I've lost in my life to alcoholism through, car accidents, drinking and driving to whatever, right? From a young age, I lost somebody at one of our grad parties. Brother was drunk, rolled the car, she got thrown out. Died, right? Life was over because of alcohol. And, you look at the different circumstances in our lives in regarding to addiction to alcohol, drugs, or whatever, it does cost more because we don't think of the person. Like I knew a family, and this is going to be sorry for those that take this to be very emotional because it was. I knew a family that the mom and dad were killed and four kids were left orphaned. This is about 20 years ago from a guy that many businesses do it, not just in Canada. 5 o'clock Friday, they're done work. They're all starting to have a few cocktails in the back room of the shop. And again, mostly men. And young guy, 20 something, got into the vehicle in a big truck. And he went over the line, hit them and killed them, right? What are the consequences of that alcohol to that family emotionally, to the people that had to support them, to the mental and emotional problems that young guy, who's not young anymore, has gone through most likely most of his life because of it? All because society has sensationalized, hey, grab a case of beer, 5 o'clock when we're done, we're all going to sit in the back, we're going to all have a few pops, right, a few soda pops, a few, beers, and we're going to get in our vehicle and we're going to drive. I see that at my sporting events here, and it makes me absolutely nauseous. So part of the problem, and I'm bringing it up, and I know it's not just here, because I talk to people in the US and other people in the UK and around Europe. They'll leave that sporting event and the cops have a blind eye while people get in their vehicles totally intoxicated and drive away. whether it's a football game, for you rugby, whether it's hockey, right? The list goes on, and it bothers me. It makes me nauseous that there's nobody doing anything about it. The regulations say they can't serve somebody that's drunk, but yet I see it at the games all the time, right? You're supposed to stop serving them, yet they're still serving them. Why aren't people, as they're walking out through security, they have all these guards making sure that people are leaving in a timely fashion. Why aren't you pulling somebody over that's tripping over their feet? Because I see that. And they're busy saying, oh, have a good night as they walk off. But yet that person's so impaired, they should not be leaving, even if they don't know that they're getting in a vehicle or not. What happens if that person ends up getting angry and injures something? There's fights at sporting events too around the world. Most of it's alcohol driven.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, the evidence is very, very clear that randomized and regular roadside breathalyzer tests significantly cuts the amount of drink driving. And that's not news. You know, that has been something that has been common knowledge in the alcohol policy world for years. And, you know, I don't stick up for the government in this country that often, but that is one thing that we are reasonably good at. We are quite good at randomized and regular breathalyzer checks. And drink driving, it's not totally disappeared, but it certainly has reduced considerably over my lifetime. So, you know, the solution for that, it's clear.
Mine
it's
as obvious. Well.
There's absolutely no reason not to do something about it. But why do sporting arenas turn a blind eye to the effects of alcohol? It's because, you know, where does all of the money
come?
Who's
the biggest advertiser? I look at our own sports team here, Molson Canadian, right? Coors Light. They're the biggest sponsors. They're the ones selling the alcohol, you know, and they literally, the police, though, are there. They're in full force. Then you have also the rink security and stuff, and they're letting people walk. Like, so we have a massive intersection where people have to go across to go to where the parkades are to leave at the end. Cops will be there blocking traffic to let the pedestrians all go across, yet there's somebody waving, barely able to walk. You know, they're walking to that parkade, they're getting in there. And again, I am not knocking the police because I can't imagine the pressure they're under to avoid it. When some of them probably go home and go, my gosh, I hope that person made it home and didn't kill anybody and leave somebody an orphan. Right. It's such a massive problem that people that are listening or watching, you may not realize, but next time you go to a concert, a sporting event of any type, a wedding, I don't care what it is. It can be a community party. Who's leaving that party and getting in a vehicle? They're now taking their life and using it as a weapon against other people. It may not happen that day, but it might happen eventually. Why is that happening? Why aren't we as a society? I've gone up to people saying, hey, you're not going to drive. And it's caused fights. Well, let me drive you home. Let me call you a cab. Give me your keys. And I've lost people in my life over that.
Yeah, but as you say, I mean, the alternative, it just doesn't bear thinking about, does it? And, you know, I talk a lot about the costs and I talk a lot about the statistics, and I think it is absolutely right to realize that behind those numbers, behind, you know, all of it, it's just a huge amount of suffering and pain, and it is unnecessary. It is something that we know the solution. We know how to deal with this.
Yeah, 100%. So I got a couple more things. As I had mentioned to you when we were first talking before I hit record, we might not get through everything. I'm going to have you on the show again. But there's two things I definitely want in this episode. You wrote a couple books, brother, most recently, Real Men Quit, The Armchair Macho Guide to Beating Booze and Finding the Life You Want. I know when I wrote my book, it was very cathartic. It helped me unpack some things that I didn't realize were still packed away and move forward to a more healthier life in my physical, my mental, and my emotional thought process. What was the process like for you writing that book?
Oh, free therapy. Absolutely. I'm with you 110%. So, yeah, I mean, there's been an autobiographical element to both of the books that I've written. And They've both been enormously important in helping me to understand how I got here. Will I ever really know the depth of it? Probably not, but I'm a lot clearer about it than I am now. And my most recent book, Real Men Quit, in part was inspired by a friend of mine. And, you know, you talked about people you know who you've lost through alcohol. Well, my friend John died at 27 of acute pancreatitis, which was entirely caused by alcohol. He drank very hard at university, but then again, so did I. He didn't, you know, we all misbehaved an awful lot, and it didn't seem too out of the ordinary. But I guess a lot of people we were with toned it down and went and got jobs and things like that after university. But John and I are both, you know, functionally unemployable. So we didn't quite find ourselves in the normal life. And we did a lot of drinking together, but unfortunately it took its toll on him and he died at 27. And so part of the book, you know, what I wanted to do was say to people, it doesn't have to be this way. There is an alternative. You can stop before it gets too late, because at some point, if you carry on the way you are, it will get too late. So it's helped me enormously in terms of kind of understanding our relationship and, you know, what I did and what I didn't do and what I could have done and what really, you know, making peace with all of that and putting that water under the bridge. But really what I wanted to create was something for guys, because there's not a lot out there. Most of the people who are writing about sobriety these days are women, and they're doing some amazing work, and I've got a lot of time and respect for them. But, you know, what they say makes sense to me now, 9 years after I stopped drinking, but I don't think it would have resonated with me when I was actually drinking. So I wanted to get in all of the stuff about football and rugby and James Bond and Star Wars and Terminator and a lot of really, really bad jokes. So it's definitely aimed at guys, meeting them where they're at and not being incredibly dull, or at least that's my aim.
Well, and that's good. Again, my book constantly reminds me when people bring up stuff, oh, this chapter made a difference in my life, or, you know, somebody will leave a review about the book, or it'll just come up in conversation. And it constantly reaffirms to me that this was my past and doesn't have to be my future. Oh, wait a minute. I slipped back there again. And it's a corrective thing too. It constantly reminds me, because it's out there in the world, right? It's out there in... it's made a difference in people's lives, but it still doesn't mean that all of a sudden I'm 100%. Like you were saying, I'm still a work in project the rest of my life, but it's certainly made a big difference and made me aware of where I've been, where I've gone, where I'm currently at, where I want to change. And, you know, it was a great process. It wasn't the funnest process, very emotional. Five and a half, 6 months into, you know, finally getting the book out. Some people it takes longer. It was a great thing for me, though. One of the things I wanted to mention, though, Duncan, was you conducted a research project that involved watching TV. What was that journey like? And what did you discover about the Netflix experience and outside of that as well in regards to alcohol and what we see?
So I should probably caveat by saying I'm not picking on Netflix in particular. I just happen to have a subscription and like watching TV. So what we did was there was an article in the British Medical Journal in 2019 about smoking and how it was depicted on Netflix and how incredibly common it was. So in 2019, they looked at Netflix original shows badged 15 and 18, and they found that 74% of them had smoking in them, which is a huge amount. I mean, that's a lot. And I do work with smokers. So I talk specifically about one program called Bridgerton, partly because lots of people have watched it, partly because it associates glamour and smoking and pretty women and smoking, which is something that the tobacco industry has been banging for about, you know, 100 years, since basically movies have started. They started in with this idea of, you know, Lauren Bacall, cigarette in hand, sophisticated women. So I talk about that quite a lot. And when the second series of Bridgerton came out, which was crucially after this British Medical Journal article and after Netflix got into a load of trouble, what I noticed about the second series was there was less smoking in it, but there was more drinking. And I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. So how much alcohol is on Netflix? So we did a similar study to the one that was published about smoking, but just around alcohol. So Netflix original shows badged 15 and 18, and we found that 86.5% of them have got alcohol in them. But what I think is most interesting about what we found was when they put alcohol in the show. So the average time was just a shade under 10 minutes, which probably doesn't surprise most people. They're not going, wow, the smoking gun, 10 minutes. But if you actually look into product placement research, what you will find is the ideal time to place a product in a drama is about 10 minutes, because people have settled enough that it has the effect. If you put it right at the start, they don't notice it so much. If you put it at the end, they're too involved in the program, so they just get caught up and they miss it. 10 minutes, absolutely the sweet spot, and that is where typically alcohol gets featured on Netflix.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. Again, not picking on Netflix, because it's in a lot of different, it's just they're regurgitating stuff that they don't even produce either. It's in mass television, out of Hollywood or wherever the case may be, in the UK, in Europe, it don't matter where it is in the world. It is sensationalized and normalized. And I see it. And I'll be sitting there with my son or one of my other adult, five adult kids, and we'll talk about it. And I'll say, you know, is that real life, what we're just seeing? Like, there's no way that somebody's going to walk into a room and they're going to have a meeting with this person they've never met and said, hey, you want a cocktail? I'm pouring myself one right here. Here, have some whatever booze it is. It doesn't even matter what it is. And they're sitting there and they're drinking. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, now that scene's over. They just finished drinking 3-4 ounces of alcohol and they're going out. And now what? And I think about those people I've lost in my life. To people that drink and drive.
One of my favorite things that I noticed recently, I was watching Griselda, which it was quite good. If you like, it was quite violent. It's about a cocaine trafficker in Florida in the 80s. And that's one of the reasons why I was intrigued by it. And we're currently doing a 1 minute interval study on it, but we haven't finished it. So I can't give you the numbers yet. But we picked on it because it's ostensibly about cocaine. Yeah, there's very little cocaine in it. There is an awful lot of smoking, like literally, you know, it's like almost all of the time somebody is smoking. And there's a lot of drinking in it. And there's this one really interesting scene where they, you know, they're shooting it from various different angles. But the bottle of beer seems to move in her hand to match the shot, so that you can always see the label, which of course is just, you know, it's like a terrible example of continuity, because if you wanted it to look smooth and, you know, like well shot, you'd always have the beer bottle in the same place. But if you were maybe taking some money off Budweiser, then maybe you'd make sure the label was always featured, irrespective of where the camera was pointing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've thought about that too. It's not just product placement for alcohol. It's for anything, you know, Chevy's sponsoring this show, or it'll be a show that Chevy's not sponsoring it. And then they have the emblems or whatever blacked out on the show. Has you ever noticed that? Movies, TV shows. It's like, all right, we're going to reach out to you. Hey, we're using your Dodge vehicle, your Volvo, whatever. Pay up or we're going to gray it out, right? It's like the product placement and what they do to the person that's watching, that's not even aware, even though their subconscious sees it, is amazing. Yeah, Duncan,
nobody watches adverts anymore. Too cynical.
I go through the commercials, come on. Yeah. Or I'm watching streaming services where there's no commercials.
Yeah. So what do they do? You know, they've got to spend the advertising dollar somehow.
Yeah, of course they do. I get the game, and hopefully people listening or watching, you've had those aha moments, or you've gotten to a point where you want to reach out and learn more information from, you know, Duncan or myself or whatever to move your life forward in a positive fashion. I'm not saying your life isn't positive today, but if you've got those, you know, that pit in your stomach, you're just feeling down, you're living in quiet desperation, you're worth it. There's help out there for you. Just seek it out and take that first baby step. So Duncan, if you had to give our listeners one last closing message, what would you tell them in regards to giving a heck and never giving up?
Well, do you know, I just want to echo what you've already said. I don't think you can sum it up better than saying you're worth it. You know, that's one of the things that I don't think we can repeat often enough. You are enough. You are a whole and complete human being. You don't need alcohol. You know, you don't need junk food. You don't need cigarettes. It's an awful lot of things in life you don't need, because you have everything inside you that you need to live a happy, fulfilling life, to give a heck and, you know, really go and do it.
Yeah, I love that. It all boils down to it. We're all worth it. We're all working projects for the rest of our lives till we take our last breath. What are we willing to sacrifice? What are we willing to invest in ourselves and get out of the comfort zone? Because no success in life, I don't care what aspect of your life, has ever happened sitting in our comfort zone, sitting there wallowing in self-pity and grabbing another bottle of beer or grabbing a joint or grabbing more food. The list goes on of the addiction things that slow people down and growth in their lives. So Duncan, our time is almost up. I want to respect our listeners and your time. However, before we end, can you please tell the listeners what's the best way they can reach you?
So if you can spell Bhaskar M. Brown, I am really, really easy to find, but most people can't even pronounce it. So to make life a little bit easier for your listeners and to offer them a little bit of a free gift, they can get a copy of my first book, Get Over Indulgence. All they have to do is put getover.uk into the internet, and that will take you to a bit of my website where you can download it. Kindle, PDF, or if you can stand to listen to me for 3 hours and 45 minutes, you can listen to the audiobook. So that's just getover.uk. They say that's a bit of our website. All of the good stuff is on there. All of the socials are on there. So feel free to connect with me, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram. And if you've got any questions, please do reach out. I love to help people. And that's what I'm all about. So yeah, please get in touch.
I appreciate that. Anybody that's new to the show, go to giveaheck.com, go to the podcast top where it says podcast. You click on it, you'll see Duncan's face. You'll be able to read abbreviated show notes and highlights of this show, as well as find all the things he's mentioning, social media links, website. I'll make sure it's all in there, including what he just mentioned about getting the book for free. I really appreciate your time, Duncan. It's been really enlightening, great conversation. Any last words before I wrap up the show?
It's been a heck of a show.
Thanks for the originality. So thanks so much for being on Give a Heck, Duncan. I appreciate your time and sharing some of your experiences so that others too can learn it is never too late to give a heck.
Thank you for taking time out of your day and listening to Give a Heck. If you find value, I'd appreciate you sharing with your friends and family so they too can learn how to live life on purpose, not by accident. So you do not miss the next episode, please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform, and please also post a review. I look forward to reading your comments. This has been Dwight Heck. If you want to check out other podcast episodes or today's show notes, please check out my website, giveaheck.com. And until next time, together let us all strive to give a heck.